Hey friends, welcome back to the Work Your Wealth podcast, the show where we're teaching you how to make smarter choices with your money. I'm your host, Mary Beth Storjahan, certified financial planner and founder of Workable Wealth. Today on the show, I'm super excited to have estate planning attorney Nikki Szymanczyk on the show. Nikki has her own business, Szymanczyk Law Group, and it's a business, nonprofit, and estate planning firm that's located in San Diego. She started her business because she wanted to create a modern law firm that felt accessible to clients. As an entrepreneur herself, Nikki has a real passion for helping other business owners realize their dreams. She truly believes that a huge part of her job as a business attorney is teaching, motivating, and inspiring her clients to dream big. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited to have you here. We haven't talked about estate planning on the podcast yet. I've had a few attorneys on, but it's always more focused on business or contract law. And I think this is a really important topic that basically applies to everybody in one way or another.
Sure. Yes, it definitely does.
So to kick off everything, when people hear the words estate planning, I don't know if you feel the same, but I feel like their eyes automatically glaze over and they kind of check out. So what is estate planning and how is it related to our lives and why should we care about it?
Sure. I think it is really scary for people and they kind of don't know what it means. A lot of people will kind of use the TV version and they'll picture having a will and the reading of the will, that scene that's like really popular on movies, which actually doesn't happen in real life. But essentially, estate planning is really just planning for what will happen when you're no longer around or when you aren't able to make your own decisions. So it's really just security and making sure that all of the assets that you have will go to who you want them to go to in the way you want them to go to them. And should something happen to you and you're not able to make your own medical or financial decisions and you are still alive, the decisions that you want to be made will be made by the person you want them to be made by. So that's kind of what it is in a nutshell.
And so why do you think people are resistant to doing estate planning? I don't know if you see this as well, but a lot of people avoid the topic altogether because obviously nobody wants to think about the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I think it has to do with two things. One is people don't like to think about their death. It's scary. And it, for a lot of people, it brings up a lot of emotional things. And I get to dive into those with clients and see, you know, why are they so scared? And a lot of times it has to do with things they've seen happen in their own families. So that could be one of them. The other one is people assume that you only do estate planning when you have a lot of money. And so people, I'll have clients that say, well, I don't have a lot. My estate's really simple. And then when we dive into it, we realize that they have enough to do estate planning. Everyone has enough to do estate planning because really estate planning is just a set of documents that gives you security for what you do have. So any amount is worth doing an estate plan. It's just a matter of what type will suit you based on your assets.
And one of the perspectives that I take with clients, and I think a lot of us in the financial planning industry take, is that estate planning is for you, but it also isn't for you. It's mostly for those that you're leaving behind or those who will be left in the decision-making power or with the decision-making authority because you're documenting what your wishes are and giving them something to go off of.
It's so true. And that's why a lot of the clients that I get are actually clients whose parents have recently passed away and they didn't have any planning or they did have a really comprehensive plan and everything went smoothly. And so those clients are the ones that really fully understand how important it is to do this for your loved ones. So yes, during your lifetime, having an estate plan might not impact you very much. But certainly when you do pass away, having everything together and organized and a real comprehensive plan in place is going to benefit your family tremendously.
And talking about that everybody can have an estate plan, because I agree, I think everybody should have something documented, something on paper, and that reflects your wishes that those left behind can go off of. Saying that everybody has something in place, what does that mean when we say that somebody has an estate plan? I know what documents I recommend for clients, but there's a lot of terms that are thrown out there.
And so sure,
can you go through some of the basics and then let's try and tie them together as well. So go ahead and maybe just like brain dump for us some of the things that you can find in your typical estate plan, because it's basically your estate plan is a series of documents, right?
It is. Yeah. So usually it comes in a binder or
why does it come in a binder, by the way? Why does it still come in a binder? Can you answer that question for me?
And it's so funny because, you know, my whole practice model is really to have like a virtual modern law firm, but yet we still have the estate plans and there's still paper.
Is it required of you? Is it required?
Yeah, they need a hard copy of just the will, really. But clients love to get that binder. It makes them feel very official.
It is official. And then I have to ask my clients to scan it in for me because then they're like, oh, all I have is binder. I'm like, sorry, you need to now scan 100 pages.
I always give an electronic copy too.
That's smart. See, that's good. Good business practice.
So yeah, the documents that's included in a typical estate plan. So the foundational document is usually a living trust. Not to get state specific, but if you're in California, you typically need a living trust. In other states, you might be able to just have a will. So you have a trust, and that big document is really what sets forth all the assets that you have. So it's a great place to actually put a schedule of your assets, because imagine if you were to pass away tomorrow, not everyone has a place where they've documented everything that they own and how someone would access it. So that's a really helpful bit there. It also is a place to hold your assets, the title to your assets. So like when you have a living trust, you actually transfer your house to the living trust and you transfer your bank accounts to the living trust. And the reason you do that, we call it funding, is to make sure that the trust has power over those documents. And the reason that you have a trust is to avoid having to go to court to have any of your assets transferred. So it's a way of staying out of court, staying out of the probate process, which can be very long and in California, very, very expensive. So the trust is really just an instruction manual. It says, I appoint these people as trustees after I'm gone. And these are the type of decisions that I want them to make with my money and my assets. And this is who I want my assets to go to. Trusts can get, they're usually revocable. If you have a great deal of assets, sometimes you'll do an irrevocable trust for certain planning reasons, but the typical family will just need a revocable living trust. So that's the foundational document.
And so what, going back just the trust versus the will, what are the differences there? And I know we said in California, you typically need one, but why would you only need a will? What circumstances would you only need a will in? Because I know that comes up a lot with some of my clients is, do we need a trust? Do we need a will? What can be accomplished with either?
So with a will, it's basically just a document that says, this is what I have and this is who I want it to go to. And so it's usually a lot more simple. With a trust, it's a document that will avoid having to go to court. So with a will, you still need to take that will to court, but now you have proof of how you want your assets to be distributed. So you show that proof in the form of the will to the court and you lodge it with the court. And that's how the court will decide where your assets get distributed based on your will. If you have nothing, then the state decides for you, which is a scary proposition. But with the trust, you actually don't have to go to court at all. So you avoid all of that. And the reason I say in California, it's really good because our probate process here takes a long time. It's typically a year to a year and a half, and it's really expensive. Other states, the probate process is much easier. So maybe in those states, it would make more sense just to do a will. But what I love about trusts for people with families is that you can provide that your children will not get all of your assets all at once in one lump sum.
It's my favorite part.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you can do a lot of really cool things to incentivize your kids. So if you want them to get an education or you want them to prioritize certain things in their lives, you can incentivize them with money. And so it's just a way of making sure that your assets are going to be given to your family as you would have if you were also alive.
And that's one of the things I look for in trusts for clients is understanding, hey, do you want your kids to have full access to their inheritance when they're 18 or 25 or 35? And how do you want that spread out? Because an 18 or 25 year old with immediate access to hundreds of thousands of dollars or $1 million even is probably handle it very differently than a 35 year old with access to some of that money. And so that's the stuff that a trust can stipulate.
Exactly. It's so true. And clients feel differently about it based on, you know, their own personal experiences, but almost all of them say, even at 25, if I were to have gotten all of my parents' estate, I would not have made the right decision. So usually we'll spread it out 25, 30, and 35. But there's just a lot of creativity and a lot of different things you can do with trusts. And that's why I love them for clients.
Yeah. And the schedule of assets that you're talking about, I think a lot of people like that would be if you listen to the podcast or what I recommend that you should do, that would also be like your net worth statement. Hopefully you would have that list there. And that's some of the stuff that when you go to meet with an estate planning attorney or somebody like Nikki, you would bring that with you because that's going to document everything. So a lot of that work is already done if you are doing something like tracking your net worth already because all of your accounts and debts would be listed out. Okay. So we talked will, we talked trust. What are the other documents that are a part of an estate plan?
So there's other documents as part of the estate plan. So that would be think about your healthcare. So you have two documents usually for your healthcare. You have a healthcare power of attorney and a HIPAA document. So the healthcare power of attorney document is a document that lays out exactly what you would want to happen if you aren't able to make your own medical decisions for you. So who would you want to make those decisions? Is it your spouse? And what if he's not around? Would it be your parents or would it be your siblings? So you choose a healthcare agent to make those decisions. And I always tell clients, the person that you just choose to be your trustee or to make your money decisions might not be the same person that you choose to make your healthcare decisions, because this is a really emotional decision and some people just really can't handle that type of responsibility. So you want to choose someone who's comfortable and can be your advocate if you're not able to do it for yourself. And then the healthcare power of attorney also says what you would want to happen with your remains. You know, do you want to donate organs and for what purposes? Do you want to be cremated? And then during your life, what would you want to happen if, you know, you had an irreversible condition or they didn't think they could wake you up out of that coma? Would you want to be kept alive on life support or would you want them to let you go? So it's those types of decisions that you can make in that healthcare power of attorney. Sometimes it's called a healthcare directive, and that can be just give you a lot of peace of mind. I know a lot of times at hospitals, they'll encourage you, if you're going in for major surgery, to complete one of those. If you already have an estate plan, then that's already done for you and you don't need to make it in that kind of hectic emergency type of situation.
Yeah, I know I had to send a copy of my healthcare power of attorney in when I had both kids, when I had both my babies. I had to submit that to the hospital ahead of time because they were asking for who would be making those decisions if I couldn't make them for myself.
Exactly.
And so the healthcare power of attorney, is that also the living will? Is that what it's referred to also sometimes? Or is that something else? I hear living will a lot.
Yeah, some people will call it a living will. It's kind of a living will can be a different document. There can be more wishes expressed in it.
Okay.
They're not as common.
Okay. So that's the healthcare directive, which has a lot of the really heavy stuff that we don't want to talk about. And I mean, even for us, and I talk openly about things that we kind of consider in our household, who we do have for our to make the medical decisions is different from the trustees because we happen to have a family member who has a medical background. So
exactly.
We opted to have the person with a medical background to make those decisions. It is so emotional that whereas I would love to have some of my closer family members, I think it would put them in a tougher spot to have to make that decision. So when you are thinking about those things, if there is a medical background or somebody you know who would maybe take a little bit of the emotion out of it and do the practical right thing, then there's that as well.
And then there's also the HIPAA document, which we all kind of know what HIPAA is when we go to the doctor now, and there's all these HIPAA privacy rules. And that basically says who can receive your healthcare information. So sometimes if you have kids that are going away to college, a really great thing to have them do for planning. Some people think maybe it's too young, but it really isn't. If they're going away to college and they're 18, they should have a healthcare directive and a HIPAA for the reason that if something should happen to them, you know, you're the parents would be the ones to be able to make those decisions, and you can rest assured that you'd be able to get their healthcare information. So that can be really helpful too.
Okay. And then I think where there's one more document, what would be the...
There's a few more. So even though, even though you have a trust, you actually have a will too. Clients get really confused.
Oh, right. Yes.
That. Yeah. So we usually, if you do have a trust, it's called a pour over will. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a catch-all. It's the document that says, I want all of my assets to be poured into my trust. And that way, if you leave anything out, it's not a big deal. And you could get those assets put into your trust if you pass away. Because sometimes clients will forget to put a bank account or they'll buy a new house and they forget to put it in the name of the trust. So the pour over will helps with that. And the pour over will is also one of the places where we usually designate guardians for young children. So that's really important.
So let's talk about the guardianship for a minute. I know that's hard. And I know we struggle with it on our end too, who to name. And we've actually gone back and updated it since we've had kids. And also note that these are all updatable things.
Yes.
It's not written in concrete. But what are some of the concerns that you see people coming to you with? And what are some ways that you've been able to help them address the guardianship side of things?
So guardianship is a really complicated question. It's like, I think it's one of the things that prevents people from doing this type of planning is they can't really... Spouses have a tendency not to be able to get on the same page and they feel really overwhelmed with the decision. And yes, it could be updated. I know if you have younger siblings, sometimes they're the people that you'd want, but they're just not ready right now. And so you kind of have to wait for them to catch up in life. So it's something that should be updated continuously as your life changes, as your parents get older. So that's definitely a factor. I've seen clients that live in, you know, California and have families in other states that really struggle with the decision of who to appoint as guardian because they have concerns about their kids having to move to another part of the country. So that can be an issue. What I do is in the documents that I prepare, I appoint the guardian in the will because that's the document that actually does get lodged with the court. So that makes it official. And then I also include a comprehensive guardianship document. So that guardianship document is really a place to explain in further detail how you want your guardians to make decisions about your kids. So one great one that I love is, so say you appoint your own mother and father as the guardians, you can say, you know, though we appointed the wife's parents as guardians, you know, we really want to make sure that the kids spend time with both sides of the family. And we want both sides of the family to be involved in their upbringing. Or we want to make sure that they spend summers in Wisconsin or whatever it is. You can put those details in there to make sure that both sides of the family can be involved in the kids' upbringing in some way. And there are a lot of other types of instructions that you can put in this more comprehensive guardianship document. So how do you value education? Is there a religious upbringing that you want your kids to continue with? So those types of documents can be included. And I like to think of it as kind of like a little instruction manual for your guardians.
And that's not necessarily filed with the court, right?
No.
That's just basically what's left for the guardians or those that you've appointed to work off of knowing what your wishes are.
Exactly. Another important point that I think people sometimes overlook is you don't always want your guardian of your kid to be the same as your trustee of your trust.
Yep.
So the money person should not always be taking care of the kids.
Agreed.
Unless you have older parents and there would be no potential for commingling with their own children. But I always like give the example of all of a sudden your guardian decides to take their whole family to Disney World with your kids' trust fund. You just don't want them to be in charge of the money. You want a series of checks and balances. So you want the guardian to have a trustee that they would go to and be able to say, look, maybe we need a bigger house or we need money for school or we need this. And you want to make sure that those two people communicate well and they have a good relationship because you're really setting them up for potentially many years of working together.
I think that's such an important note. And it is one that I talk to a lot of clients about as well, that is that you don't have to have guardians the same as the money people and that it's okay to have that separate. Do you recommend as part of your process or just kind of maybe after you finalize the documents, at what point in time should people be checking in with the people that they're appointing in these roles? Do you recommend, hey, ahead of time confirming who you're naming as guardian or who you're naming as trustee? Or is it, nope, surprise them afterwards? Or how do you have people navigate those conversations?
I mean, it's so funny, you know, people would never drop their dog off at someone's house when they're going on vacation without warning them, right?
Right.
So I don't know why you would do the same with your children. I think it's a conversation you should definitely have. I've had clients who just assume that their family members would want to move to this state and raise their kids. And the fact is they don't. They have their own plans. And that's impacted their decisions on who they decide to appoint. So I think it's something you definitely want to discuss with them and make sure that they're in a place in their lives that they'd want to take on that responsibility. I think it would be really difficult for someone to decline that job after. There would be a big sense of responsibility.
So just kidding. Never mind.
Yeah. So I think it's the guardianship one. I would definitely recommend talking to them in advance. In terms of trustee and, you know, the financial power of attorney, which we haven't talked about yet, the money decision person, I don't necessarily think that you have to talk to them about it in advance, but you want to choose someone who is the type of person who would take on that job and be good at it. So I always say like someone who's really good with administrative tasks, someone who's maybe a bookkeeper or who has been trustee for someone in the past or someone you know is just really good at taking care of business and managing finances. And your most responsible family member or friend is usually that type of person. And usually people are pretty honored to take on that job. It's not always a fun one, but I usually include in the documents that they'll get some type of compensation for their time because it can, depending on how your estate is, it can be a big job to be someone's trustee.
Are we missing any other documents?
We didn't talk about the durable power of attorney. Okay. So that is the document. So it's also financial. So usually you'll appoint the same person as your trustee to be your agent for power of attorney. And that's the document that if you're incapacitated and you're not able to make your own financial decisions, and think about it, it's really someone stepping into your shoes. They need to be able to pay your mortgage and take money out of your bank and handle all of your financial decisions. So that's the person, that's a document where you appoint that person, and we usually give them pretty broad powers to step in your shoes and make those financial decisions.
So once all the documents are created, what do you typically recommend? Do people just carry their binder around with them? How does everybody who's listed get a copy? How do you ensure that people have the appropriate documents, or would they just give your name as like, here's my attorney, if something happens to me, call this person, which I assume is not what you do.
So one thing is that I actually like about the binder is it's big and it says estate planning, and that's what I recommend. So if you do go to an attorney, make sure that you get some type of thing where you can put it on your shelf. Because what happens when you pass away is people go to your house and they look around and they say like, okay, do they have a will? Because they don't usually know what a trust is. So like, do they have a will? And they start looking around, and you want a document like a binder or something, like a red flag that says, here it is. Because the worst thing is when time and money is wasted on attorneys looking for documents. And so never ever put them in a safe deposit box, because you actually have to go to court to get access to that safe deposit box. You have to open probate to do that. So you don't want your planning documents to avoid probate to be located in a box that can only be accessed with probate.
It's funny you say that, because it's true, right? People do that.
And then, yeah. So you want it really out in the open, and then you want it electronically too. So I always share it through like a secure client portal, which they can always access. And then I recommend that they download it and give it to their family members, unless you have privacy considerations and there's things in there you don't want them to be aware of right now. Give it over to them, because it really will save them a lot of time later on having to search for it.
Perfect. Okay. And so I think the other question that comes up a lot with clients is whether or not they need to work with an attorney. A lot of people, depending on where their estates and assets are, everything varies, right? And then attorneys, same thing with financial planning. They're like, what do you charge? And do I need to do this? And so When it comes to going online versus using an attorney, I guess, what are the differences and what are you looking for? And is there a point when you know you definitely should work with an attorney, or is it just, no, always you should go work with somebody in person? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, you know, I have a lot of clients that will start with LegalZoom for, you know, their business formation, for example. And I don't have a big problem with that at all. You have to start someplace. And if you can't afford an attorney, I'm happy that you get something in place. I feel differently with regard to estate planning on that. I think you always need an attorney. I think the problem with estate planning is that some people will do it and then they'll just put it away on a shelf and not think about it for years and years and years. And that's a scary prospect, because not only do laws change, but our lives change. You know, people get divorced, people have children with special needs, things change. And so too should your plan change. And so if you're to go online and do something, prepare a document on there, you're not building a relationship with someone who's going to update you on those changes to the law and who can answer questions as your life changes and who reminds you on a continuing basis, hey, these things need to be updated. So I fear that those people would really be at a disadvantage and have a plan that really doesn't suit them. And I'm not sure that it's always the case that no plan is better in the case of doing something online that could really not suit your real intentions.
That makes sense. Is there anything else that you think people should know when it comes to estate planning?
I think that the process doesn't have to be scary. It doesn't have to be really expensive. I think what I find is that clients have peace of mind when it's over. They feel it's like adulting 101. They feel good.
Total adulting. Totally.
They feel really good about having it. And then they start telling all their friends like, oh, I got my estate plan. Do you have one? And it's like a badge of honor. And the reason is because you just know it's like a box. It's box checks in your life that you're like, okay, I've taken care of this. I can know if something happens to me tomorrow that the instructions for what needs to happen are in place. And so it doesn't have to be really expensive. It doesn't have to take forever. You just need to find an attorney that you feel comfortable with, you can be open and honest with, and that you can, you know, come up with a suitable plan for your future.
One of the things that I recommend to clients, it's from standard in the industry, I guess, is to review your documents and possibly update them every 10 years or when your situation changes. Do you agree with the 10-year timeline, or is it something where you need to be looking at these more consistently, like every 5 years or annually? I guess, how often are you trying to update these documents?
I don't think that you need to update them annually, but every 10 years is probably a little too infrequent to think about it. So only because the laws change. So for example, right now our estate tax exemption amount for a married couple is over 20 right. million. So most of us aren't having any issues with paying estate taxes when we pass away. So we can pretty much do simple planning. But several years ago, when I started practicing in this area, it was a million. And so those are changes in the law that the average person just might not be aware of. And so you kind of need to keep up on those types of things or make sure that your attorney is updating you on those things. And certainly big life changes. Also with the healthcare power of attorney and the durable power of attorney, the financial power of attorney, those documents, I have heard that banks and hospitals sometimes will not, they don't want them to be really old. They want them to be within the last 5 years. I personally haven't seen any denied, but that's the standard of what I hear in my industry was that those ones need to be updated pretty frequently.
That's interesting. Okay. So this is a lot. I know it's super heavy, but I think this is a really important topic that a lot of people do not address. And I feel like even when I do financial plans for clients, estate planning is the one that just gets kicked down the road, unless there's like some immediate like life event. But this is a really important topic. And it's one that if you do work with a financial planner, it's one that will come up again and again. And hopefully this person will nag you until you get it done. So, okay, Nikki, let's transition to the wrap-up question.
Okay.
Okay, so what is the best financial advice you have ever received?
Oh, okay. So I have two. One is for personal and one's for my business. The personal one, I think this one's pretty common, the Dave Ramsey snowball effect.
Yes.
So for me, my husband and I are both lawyers. We both have student loans. So using that technique has really helped us to kind of tackle those student loans one at a time. We actually have like a big chalkboard and we keep our loans, the amounts, the interest rates, and our payoff date. And we review that often. And when we are able to pay something off, we're about to pay two of them off this year, we always have a big celebration. So we open a bottle of champagne or something to make sure that we celebrate that achievement.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that one's been good. And then for my business, before I started my business, I read Profit First by Mike Michalowicz. Mm-hmm. And that book has really changed the way that I tackle my business finances. I felt really lost before that book. And it's basically a system of deciding how much you're going to save for taxes, to pay yourself, and for the expenses of your business, and to ensure that you're not eating up all of the income from your business with expenses. And so that's helped me tremendously. And I recommend that to a lot of my business clients, and I've seen success for them as well.
Yeah, that's a good system. I always get a little leery on its percentages, but I definitely like the system.
I have the same feeling about the percentages. I think it's something that you have to really work with your advisors to come up with something that works and kind of rework it as your business evolves.
Agreed. Okay. And then what is the worst money advice you've ever received?
Oh, this one's really hard. So I think it's, for me, it's a lack of advice, a lack of understanding and a lack of confidence surrounding money, and sort of like a lie that I was telling myself for a long time that I wasn't good with money and I believed it. I think we all have a money story that kind of impacts how we view money and all of our emotions around money. Mm-hmm. And it took me a little while to unpack that and see why I believed I wasn't good with money. But I was actually figured it out in law school. I was so careful with my finances and so careful with budgeting because it was student loans. And I realized I had all these friends that kept saying like, oh, you're so careful with money. You're so good with money. You're so frugal. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm terrible with money. And I realized that was a lie. I was telling myself this lie, and it caused me to be afraid to cash my student loans checks, afraid to make decisions and look at my bank account. And once I stopped telling myself that lie or that bad advice, I have felt so empowered to make really positive financial decisions, and I feel so much more secure around money.
Money mindset is huge. I feel like it's a huge thing when you shift your mindset.
It really is.
Okay, so what's your favorite money mistake you've made then?
So my favorite money mistake is actually going to law school. So, and it's funny because I love being a lawyer, but law school is expensive. And I was the first one in my family to ever go to college at all. And so definitely not law school. No one had gone. And I had to get loans to go to undergrad and to go to law school. So it was very expensive. And it's something that is impacting, you know, my life still to this day. And a lot of people told me not to do it. That, you know, I think a lot of people are giving the advice now that maybe going to school isn't the best financial decision. But for me, it really was. There was no stopping me. I wanted to be a lawyer since I was 10. So I kind of just ignored all that advice and said, like, whatever, I'm doing this. And I love being a lawyer. It's such a big part of who I am. And I love just being someone that can help clients with the specialized knowledge that I gained in law school. So I wouldn't trade that for anything. And I think it's provided me a lot of security. You know, I'm able to have my own law firm and create the life that I want because of that education. So even though it is a burden, that financial burden, it's created a real sense of freedom for me that I think is invaluable.
I love that. Okay. And then finally, this is the one I was telling you. I know what a lot of people say. What does being wealthy mean to you?
Yeah, I think this is probably the answer that everyone probably gives, but it's really a sense of freedom and security. So it's not all about money for me and being wealthy and being rich in that traditional sense, but knowing that every day I can make decisions for me and my family based on our passions and wants that aren't all tied to financial decisions, and to not live under that like burden and shame that sometimes money can have, to feel that money is empowering our lives. We really want to travel extensively. So being in a place to be able to see the world with my family and know that we have security and we have a solid future ahead of us, I think that would be being wealthy to me.
I love that answer. Okay, Nikki, tell our listeners how they can contact you.
So they can go to my website. It is www.semanchiklawgroup.com, S-E-M-A-N-C-H-I-K, lawgroup.com. And my email is Nikki, N-I-K-K-I, at Semanchik Law Group.
Great. Well, I will be sure to link to Nikki's website, email, all of her contact information in the show notes.
Thank you.
Nikki, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this information. I think it's so helpful.
Thank you. It was great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to today's episode of Work Your Wealth. If 2019 is the year you want to make smarter choices with your money, head over to workablewealth.com/contact and schedule your free consultation to see if financial planning is right for you in 2019.